Hello, and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. In this episode, part one of two, I'm talking to journalist Maureen O'Grady. Now, originally, the intention was to talk about the September 1965 issue of Rave magazine, for which Maureen wrote. However, such is Maureen's incredible career, we don't get beyond the introductions. But believe me, it's worth it. Maureen started as a writer for Boyfriend magazine before moving to the legendary Rave in 1964, where she worked until 1970. From then on, she became a freelance writer and later reunited with her old friend Tony Barrow as a press officer for acts such as Glen Campbell, Gladys Knight, and even Jerry Lewis. And in 1974, she began a six-year career as press officer at Decca. In the 1960s, all the major acts were friends with Maureen, regularly meeting up with her at the Scotch at St. James Club, and as you can imagine, she's bursting at the seams with incredible anecdotes. In this episode, Maureen discusses her first job at Boyfriend magazine, where she became pals with the Beatles. I loved meeting Maureen, and as you'll hear, I basically say hello, and off she goes. I hope you enjoy. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist Maureen O'Grady. Hello.
Hello, Chris. Welcome to Chelsea, by the river.
Very nice. So we're going to talk about Rave magazine, which you worked at for a while, but tell me how you first, so many people I know in publishing get into it by mistake.
Absolutely.
How did you get into it?
Well, I left school, still supposed to be the best girls' school in London, still totally unable to do anything. So I managed to get my parents to send me to a secretarial college in the City of London called Cripplegate. But every day, instead of going to an agency to find a job, I would head to the coffee bars of Soho with the money allowance my parents had given me and just sat there all day meeting people and socialising. And one day, I think it was probably September 62, after also just having had about a three-month holiday in Rome, which I'd stretched out to full capacity, I thought I would go to an agency just so that when I went home, I could honestly say I tried, but nobody wanted me, because they couldn't understand why I'd been to a good college, I had all these qualifications, and nobody wanted me. So I went to the Alfred Marx Bureau in Soho Square, just around the corner from my usual coffee bar, Les Enfants Terribles in Dean Street.
Nice.
And it was about 5 to 5. I think they're on the brink of closing. And I said, I don't suppose you've got anything. And they said, yes, yes, there's something. It's just in Regent Street. We'll phone them up. They seemed very desperate. In Regent Street, which of course wasn't far, walkable. And they said, I'll phone them up. And they said, yes, yes, they'll wait for you. It's working on a magazine. I don't think I ever bought any of these. I used to buy all the kids, the, you know, that school friend and all those ones. I don't think I actually bought the pop one. So I think I knew the name, but I don't think I ever bought Boyfriend. Anyway, I turned up at the office and the editor happened to be deaf, which some accident during the war. So he talked, he was Scottish and from Dundee, very famous for all the journalists. And he actually was the original one, I think, on the Sabino, Dandy, all that sort of stuff, DC Thompson. Ken Walmsley, and two people there. There was Maggie Cooney, who later went on to do Hello, all those sort of magazines, and Penny Valentine, who very well known in journalism,
yes.
Pop journalism. They were there as well, I think, to help the interview. And Ken did a sort of a dictation, and I sat there and sort of disinterested, but distracted by all these sort of pin-up posters on all the walls. Dictated, but it was like a monitor, it was like, dear sir, with a Scottish accent. And I was sort of writing it, but wasn't. I was like, sort of, like, this is all a shock. I thought, I don't want this to happen. And at the end of it, they put me in a room with a typewriter and said, right, now, can you type it all back?
Oh, no.
So I tried to type back this dictation, and it was really literally every other word. And I handed it in, and I said, I'm sorry, like, you know, this is the best I could do. I said, I really couldn't understand what he was saying. It was... And they said, just a minute. They went in, Penny and Maggie went in the other room and gave it to Ken. And so very, very quickly, they came back and said, yes, yes, fine, you've got the job. And I was like, I don't understand what's happened. He came in, he said, yes, yes, that's fine. When can you start? And I said, and I think it's like a Thursday or something. And they said, I said, Monday? Yeah, I was like in this sort of thing. They said, yeah, that's fine, Monday. And I later found out that it was because they'd had a lot of people come through, that they had decided that the next person that walks in gets the job. So it was really, the dictation was actually a formality. I had the job anyway. But I started looking around. There was all these pinups, lots of American sort of faces on the wall, things like sort of Bobby V, Bobby Darin, obviously loads of Cliff, Adam, people like that. And I was his secretary.
Because then Penny left. Wasn't there an argument
That's
over
right.
a holiday?
She wasn't, no, she, well, yes, she was getting married. And for some reason, and she could be quite militant and firm, she always used to stand up and say, we deserve more pay. And she was quite sort of like that. And she wanted 3 weeks honeymoon, not the annual, like in those days, it was quite strict, 2 weeks. And Ken, for some reason, said, no, 2 weeks, that's it. And I think, looking back, I suppose it, he didn't want a precedent set. Maybe that's all I can think of, because Penny was a very valued member of staff. Yeah, the main writer. So it was sort of put to me, could I fill in until Penny was replaced? And I said, no, I used to go pink. And even if someone like Cliff Richard was in two rooms away and came into the office, I go, they go, ah, Cliff's here. And I go, oh.
So had you done any writing before that?
No, apart from, you know, English language, you know, sort of actually school stuff. And at college, it was general correspondence. No, so, but obviously I could spell. I had a quite reasonable level of education. So considering I actually came from sort of the East End of London, I got these scholarships. I did quite well, but no, no experience at all. And just gradually, but I must say this, I mean, you know, being quite honest, a lot of it, apart from pretty much biographical stuff, like, you know, where do you come from, da, da, da. What, and it pretty much, looking back to start with, was like, what's your favourite colour? I could have actually had a list.
Mm.
And probably, looking back, that's probably what I had.
Right.
I had it all written out. What's your favourite colour? Who's your favourite film star? Da, 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 da. What kind of girls do you like? I mean, that was, but this was the market and that's what girls want you to know. What's your favourite meal? Anyway, very, very thrown at the deep end. As I said, that must have been about September, October 62, and dealing with all correspondence and fans, readers' letters as well, probably. Then Penny left. I'm not quite sure when she left, but it was within months. The Beatles happened.
No, honey. Look at that. Hello? Hello? This is our latest record.
We got three then.
I remember sort of, it must have been over the Christmas time, we'd get all these cards because it was led a lot by readers' letters, and whether it was a concerted effort or not, we started getting things like, please, can you put a picture of the Beatles in? We go, Beatles? We go, they haven't even spelt it right. You know, we think of the insect, right? They can't even spell Beatles, not thinking of beat as in music beat. And like, no. And we saw pictures. I think there was sort of some sort of handout publicity picture. Of course, they look strange, as later Rolling Stones look sort of alien. But at the time, I mean, looking back, it was the fringe, it was the haircut, whatever, and the way they were dressed. And then gradually there was Love Me Do, and then suddenly EMI reception. That was the first time I met them, April, probably the 5th, I think, April the 5th.
Yes, tell me about that. What was your memories?
Let me see, I was there with a photographer, and I met them, and I did note... that I mainly spoke to Paul, who was very chatty, as he would always come to be, the sort of PR man of the group, the most approachable one, put it that way, from, you know, the word go. And I'd actually talked them into going, as was our way, doing, because I had a photographer with me. Oh, and they, you could see they were up and coming. Would they come to the Serpentine to have their pictures taken on, you know, back out rowing, which was actually one of my favourite personal things. So I was related to things like, I liked horse riding. So, yeah, if I get people on a horse, I can go on a horse. So, yeah, the things you know. So, yes, they all agreed. And then at the last minute, John appeared, the only one I hadn't been cleared with. The others were all quite excited. Oh, we're going to go rowing at the Serpentine. And he said, no, no, we've got to go and see our accountant, which obviously at the time was quite important. So as I suddenly thought the other day, our session, the boyfriend session, could have been out on rowing boats. But the next date I was given, I had to chase it up on the Monday through Brian Epstein. You know, I said, the boys agreed to do a photo session. We couldn't do it after the reception because they were busy on the Friday. So on the Monday, straight on, you know, it was that urgent as far as we were concerned. So from the Friday reception, first thing Monday, I was on to Epstein to say the boys agreed. Anyway, there was a lot of bartering. The bartering had already started with, well, if you want them, you've got to, we've got some other acts as well. So there was a sort of trading off in the very early days, which actually just good business sense. Yes. Yeah, if you want them, can you, I can't remember who, I think, well, Billy Jay and Jerry, I think, were around at the time. You can do something on them as well. We went, yeah, fine. But just to get them, yes, you would take on these other people. So anyway, the session that turned out was, of course, it was about 2 weeks later. By then, I'm not sure when Fiona started. It was Fiona Adams joined us as the photographer.
Yeah.
And so our session, which could have been on the boats with, I'm not sure who the photographer was. It may not have been Fiona at the EMI on the reception. Turned out she'd been scouting around. She was a professional photographer who came in. We were looking for someone. We had a lot of part-time people up at that point. She came in, and her professional background, she actually scouted around for a location, and she found Euston Road, you know, the bomb sites, whatever. So I just sort of thought the other day, I said to Mark Lewison, that the session could have been boys in boats, but instead we had the Euston Road session, which was of course the famous Twist and Shout pictures.
Yeah,
which they actually used on their EP. But you know, it could have been. I don't think the rowing boats would have made. So by chance, that was the session we had, because I don't think we'd have got another one that quickly, or Fiona maybe would have saved that shot for someone else.
Yeah.
So, but Twist and Shout, I think, was part of their repertoire, so that was going to appear at some point.
So what was your, were you just carrying photographs?
First of all, they came up to the office. I remember the other day, our managing director was around at the time, and afterwards he said to me, you've got it wrong. There's no such name as Lennon. He said, it must be Lemon. I said, no, I've written it down because I was very green, so definitely didn't trust me. I said, no, his name is definitely Lennon. And they were sort of like, silly girl, she's got it wrong. And I said, no. So anyway, we went ahead with that. Yes, they came out to the office first and sort of met everyone. And then it was a very short walk down to Kingley Street where we had this very rickety sort of studio. So they did a studio session with Fiona up these stairs, past the lady on the first or second floor with the budgerigars and very dark, smelly sort of building to this thing. It was all sort of like orange crates. And I think we had about three or four rolls of different coloured paper as backdrops. So most people's studio sessions look pretty similar.
Yeah.
The setting. So from there, we then grabbed, I think it's a couple of cabs. I can't believe we all got into one because there was all the bags. Yes, I was bag carrier, coat carrier. And I would hold the coats and everything at the site. And I think we had bags of sweets and, you know, some sweets and things. And it went very, very well. But, Fiona was picked a fabulous location. And there were some other good shots along there with the concrete sort of bollards.
Yes.
Which all went into, I think, an issue. We did a special on that. I think it was a Big Beat special.
Yes. I got that.
Yeah. Yes, that was, I think it's a collector's item now. Yeah, boyfriend were very, very good at reusing or rehashing. And I think, those pictures were, and they liked sort of cutting out things and silhouette type things. Same old pictures, but used many, many.
Yeah.
I mean, later on, when I went on tour with Fiona in the autumn of that year, they even bought a Pentax for me to use, and Fiona had to give me quick lessons on. And I remember, I think it was £99, which at the time was like, wow. And they said, now look after this. And when you're not using it, give it back to Fiona to put back in the bag and take pictures. Like when Fiona's taking pictures, you just, yeah, just point it and shoot it. I mean, they were that so desperate. All these other knock-on, there was the boyfriend annual, the boyfriend this, Big Beat. There was all sort of Top Boys later on, but there's all different magazines. It was sort of, it seemed to be from the Beatles. This, the whole energised, the whole sort of industry.
Wonderful Egg Pod Express.
I mean, we couldn't get enough of them. I used to see them, I would reckon, about every 3 or 4 weeks at least during that year. But then, of course, they took off and suddenly the whole world wanted them, so they weren't so available. But I read something in a book called Love Me Do.
Oh, a Michael Brown book.
Yes, which actually mentions that Fiona and I are on the road on tour with them, which quoted me some strange quote I made in there, which I do not remember making. Like, oh, I don't make, no, I know exactly what they're going to say, so I never write it down. I thought, sure, I never said that. It might have been gibberish I was writing down, but I'm sure I wrote down something. And it was that point you could see they were sort of taking off, and that they realised in conversations that Michael Brown has put that we were like, it could be a stepping stone, but they knew there was a sort of a pathway, and you started with us. I don't know if someone had logically explained that to them. I think Tony Barrow, who actually was a journalist from Liverpool and probably knew the music business, he probably knew there was a progression. In the beginning, you feed the bass, which is the fans. And then, you know, the more, let's say, intelligent conversations or whatever, as you go up the sort of pecking order. But they were always very good fun, really nice, great company.
Liverpool, the Mersey sound, a sound that means something different from what it did when Liverpool was just an important port. Because now, much to its surprise, the great northern city has got a new industry, as incongruous as the soot on its classical buildings.
You used to hang out a lot. There's a photo of you with George.
That was at the Blue Angel. Oh, yes. We were going up to Liverpool with the help of Bill Harry from Merseybeat. He helped me organise that. Working on Boyfriend, as on Rave magazine later on, because I was the staff member, I would actually arrange, you know, the photo sessions, whatever, and the interviews. So I sort of knew all these people very well and got to know Bill through various things in London, because I seemed to know him. And I got in touch with him and said, you know, we want to come up and do an issue on Liverpool and other groups. So we went up there, and he gave me, and I think he helped me organise things like, I think there's a group called The Chance, who later became...
Oh, yes.
Real thing, basically. Real thing later on. The Undertakers, Beryl Marsden. Oh, we went a bit sideways. Manchester, we did the Hollies. Well, anyway, while we were up there, the Beatles had a sort of one of their last sort of concerts, one of their sort of, I think, £100 a night, an old booking.
Yeah.
And I think it was at the Grantham Hall. So while we were up there, I'd arranged through Tony that Fiona and I, while we're here, and they are here, we would go and see them at the Grantham Hall in Liverpool. So we booked into the Adelphi, which I must say impressed the boys. When we travelled, the office did book us into nice places. So we turned up, and these big heavies were on the door. And I said, excuse me, our name should be on the door. It's all been arranged. And they said, very polite, came back and said, no, sorry, nobody knows anything about it. So I said, no, it's definitely all been arranged. Because it was about, unless I'm going mad, I think it was a 4 or 5 hour train journey in those days. London to Liverpool, it was all stopping service. It was like an epic journey. Liverpool, you know, almost international. Liverpool. Yes, because you never usually left London for anyone. So after about 3 attempts and going backwards and forwards, conveniently there was a pub opposite the stage door of the Grand Hall. And I was, by this time, Fiona and I were sitting there, and we had all the cameras and everything there. And I went back, and I thought, this is my final attempt. So I went over the road again, and back by this time, so buoyed up with a few, I don't know, Scotch and Cokes, banged on the door and said, and the guy opened the door again. And he said, yeah, you know, very, quite sympathetically. I think he could see, like, because there were loads of sort of local girls and fans around the door anyway, so wondering who this person was that keeps marching up and banging on the door.
Yeah.
I said, I'm sorry. I said, but. I said, I was very demanding. And at that point, Epstein was walking across the back. And I said, Brian. And being a very polite man, he couldn't, you know, there was something in him. He had to turn his head. I said, just a minute, please, because I had met him a few times. I said, Brian, I said, this has been arranged by, because he said, no, Mr. Epstein, said, no, he doesn't know anything about it. I mean, you know, he didn't know that I was up there for this big session with all the other people. So as far as he knew, I was there just to see them. He didn't know, well, while we're here, we'll do that. So he was like, oh, I suppose you better come in. And I said, thank you very much. So Fiona and I, by this time, I said, we must have met them quite a few times. We walked in and they were sitting in this dressing room, sort of signing things for people. And also I later found out there was a sort of thing going on, a charity thing, which was Geoffrey Archer was there as a university student. He organised some charity thing with the Beatles. And it was some, I didn't know or realise that was there, but he actually was in the background somewhere. So we walked in and they're sort of like, very frank. What are you doing here? And I said, well, and I sort of did this big sort of, well, we've been outside for like 2 hours. Da, 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 yeah. And they said, why? I said, well, Brian said, which I wouldn't have done normally. I said, Brian said he knew nothing about it. I said, Tony Barrow, da, da, da. Yeah, it's all arranged. I said, would we come up here, da, da, if it wasn't all arranged?
Was this within Brian's earshot?
Yeah, it's just like a sort of a room about this size. Oh, yes, it was busy, but yes, he heard me. So John was always the one, he was always very good at sort of defending me. He'd go, Brian, is that right? And he said, And then Brian sort of, you know, a bit sort of flustered Brian. He came home and he said, oh, right, the running order tonight, da, da, da. And John said, you know, he was quite annoyed that we'd obviously been kept outside all that time. And my, you know, in other words, I paraphrase, sort of mind your own effing business. You just take your cut and like leave the music to us, in other words. You know, like, what do you like? Oh, what should we start with, boys? And that was it. So I think he took a sort of bit of a, not a dislike to me, but I don't know. He didn't like the way John spoke to him, but it was because of me sort of making this big thing about it. But it was quite annoying because, you know, we could have been there in Liverpool just for them. He didn't know that the next day Fiona and I were all over the place for other people. But anyway, I don't know if there's compensation or whatever, but John and George took Fiona and I to the Blue Angel, which was an after-hours drinking establishment for music people or groups or whatever in Liverpool. And people there, I mean, this was in Liverpool, and they would come up and say, because they could see Fiona sitting there with the camera, and we're sitting at a table, and I was trying to interview George, which, you know, at the end of the day and much drink later, I'm sort of trying to write. Again, I did try and take notes. And John was sitting there quite heavily drinking. But yes, they took us there. Actually, just makes me think about drink driving now I'm thinking about it, with George behind the wheel. Anyway, and these friends of theirs would come up to the table, obviously curious, like, oh, who are these people? Like these two ladies, da, da, da. And they said, you've come all the way from London? And I said, they're quite popular. I said, they're getting quite big. I said, but you've travelled all the way up here to see them. So there was a sort of...
So they weren't aware of...
Oh, they just saw, it's only John and George.
Yeah.
This sort of familiarity thing. And they were fellow groups, you know, probably still trying to make way and probably still like the boys, you know, playing the cavern. But there was this sort of almost a disbelief at this point that, you know, this was happening. But it was a funny experience. Yes, and then they drove us around. I mean, it must have been about, I don't know, 1:30, 2 in the morning, driving us around this sort of dark city. And that's that, and this is Liverpool. So a night sort of, I remember, I think, the Live at Birds building at some point, but I can't remember much more than that. But I asked John, I'm afraid, my usual, at that point still, what's your favourite? Because I think it's the first time I'd actually sat down. Obviously, in strange circumstances, to actually talk to him. So this is why I was endeavouring to take notes with a notebook. And John took, when I sort of turned to talk to John, he sort of took the book from me and did, I think the question must have been, what's your favourite girl or what would your favourite girl look like? And he took my thing and I have this drawing of this sort of strange creature that he drew in my notebook for me, which I still have, which is the page has gone yellow because it's just a page in a, you know, lined notebook, but I still have that. And And then he's got the vital statistics, which are something like 64, 39, and, you know, this sort of weird thing. But so, yeah, I didn't have much. I couldn't really, even with my Pitman shorthand, I couldn't really read any of it back, unfortunately. It was all very polite. Oh, yes, and what else?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes. Tape recordings didn't come in. When I went to see them at Bournemouth, that was a very funny incident. In the lounge of the hotel in Bournemouth when they were there for a week in the summer, the new toy of the time was a tape recorder, which I'm not quite sure at what point they acquired it, but it was quite funny in this sort of lounge where they were all sort of dotted around, having their pictures taken individually. But there was very sort of, you know, George lying on a couch and all these things like this. And John had taped on this machine something like, can we have a pot of tea and some cucumber sandwiches, please, right, on the tape machine. So we'd sit, at three or four of us, be sitting at the table, and a waiter would come. In those days, they were, well, it was a nice hotel, so they were wearing a proper outfit. And they came over and he said, yes, sir. So John very secretly sort of pressed on the machine, you see, and this thing came out, pot of tea, please, and cucumber sandwiches. So this elderly gentleman was looking around the table, like, who's talking? And he's going, yes, and he's gone, and then John's pressed it again. Pot of tea, please, and cucumber sandwiches. And this sort of man thinks, am I hearing things? And this, I mean, you can't believe it. I mean, it sounds very childish now, but because it was like a new toy, it was the height of excitement and whatever. And it made me realise that they were beginning to lead this sort of life of being locked up, you know, having to be careful where they went, whatever. Not much sort of private life as such. That the way they amused themselves, see things like this tape machine.
Well, I'm thinking that's sort of like an early bit of studio experimentation, isn't it? You know, they'd eventually go crazy with the tapes at EMI.
Yes, but I mean, it was like a new gadget, but it was to fool people, and I mean, they enjoyed it. It was fun. They were making fun of the situation because they were. I mean, a lot of it. The picture I have, like George is lying back on a couch in this sort of big lounge. A bit looking a bit sort of bored with it all. And in a way, looking at that sort of, I mean, that's the sort of year I spent with them quite a lot. When I think they went on to what, the end of the 60s and what their life, it must have been more intense. Obviously, they weren't working to the same extent, you know, like, you know, a week in Bournemouth and a week here and a week, or on the road and whatever. Cause even when I went on tour with them in the autumn, George always used to do the driving. He loved driving. And as I thought, I suddenly remembered, yes, he did the drive in Liverpool. He was the one that said, you know, with John, we got in his car to take us to the Blue Angel. He just loved driving. And later on, years later, at a club somewhere, I think it was the Scotch Club. Funny enough, it was John and George again, came in when I was there with some friends and said, oh, we're going to a party at the Moody Blues. Do you want to come along? And again, it was George in his car. Never saw John drive. I think he's bad eyesight.
Yeah, he wasn't the best driver in the world.
Well, maybe I was lucky, but I remember there was all beer cans rolling around in the back of this. I think it was like a super mini.
Yes.
Yeah, and, but it was all sort of like pretty much like anyone else's cars. There was nothing special about the one that George was driving, but on tour, on that particular tour, it was quite a big sort of limousine type thing that George was driving. And I was in the another car, a big Jag, with the promoter who'd facilitated myself and Fiona being on the tour. And we'd race, I mean, I think now it's a racing along the motorways, you know, with George in the the big limo with his boys in, and me and the Fiona and the agent going, you know, it's all great fun down the motorway. But it just lightened life up a bit, you know, because you get to the next town. I can't remember what the format was. I think it was theatre first, and then the first you saw of a hotel was after the show. And you're there, and you get up in the morning. I think we stayed with them 4 or 5 days. We travelled with them until I fell out with the agent. And I can't remember, somewhere, Leicester or wherever, I can't remember which town it was. Usual routine. I think we were only going to stay with them another day or two at the most before we made our own way back to London, because Arthur Howes was going to stay with them. As I say, it really hotted up by the autumn of 63. It was really, you know, wherever we went, it was pretty much where. And we got to the hotel that night, and Fiona and I sort of said, oh, you know, gave our names, and they said, no, there's no booking. And I thought, oh, I've really fallen out with the agent. So there we were about 11:30 at night, whatever, standing in this hotel, and because of the Beatles either being in the hotel and the sudden attention in the town that everyone, yeah, and everyone would try, and obviously the fans stay in the same hotel, there was nothing. And I said, no, so we were offered, I suppose as best we could at the time, I was offered the bath by a guy, one of the Beatles roadies. I was offered a bath. Well, it could have been worse. I was a bath to sleep in, but really there's nothing. And I said, can we phone around? They said, the whole of, you know, I think it was Leicester. No, it's all full up.
Wasn't there an ulterior motive with Arthur though?
Yes, I'm afraid so. I mean, it was so, when I think of it, it was, I think I met him at the second reception at EMI. And I said to George, would it be all right, do you think, if Fiona and I came on the road on this tour that you've got coming up? And he said, yeah, fine. He said, speak to Arthur. So unfortunately, the culture in those days was very much drink amongst everyone. So it wasn't just us. It was not just the writers. The free drink thing, even with, you know, the Beatles, everyone liked drinking. I had drunk quite a lot. And Arthur said, come back to my office. Yes, I'm sure we can arrange this. Anyway, by the time I got to his office somewhere in Soho, like Greek Street or whatever, I was violently ill in his office. So I don't know what gave him any sort of suggestion that there was anything. And if it was me, it certainly put me off. But obviously it didn't. He obviously perhaps thought I was a weak female. I don't know. But it was like, yeah, fine, we'll arrange it all. So I got back to the office and I said, I think I've arranged, we're going on the road. I said, I've been so ill. But yes, we're going to travel with Arthur, myself and Fiona. And the bookings at the hotels were sort of like, they're in single rooms and Fiona and I used to share a room. But when we got to the first hotel, I said, why is it single rooms? It was like we were being sort of separated. And I said, no, we always share a room. He said, there weren't any double rooms left. So I went to the desk. I said, do you have a double room? I said, yes. And I said, can you make those two singles a double, please? I presume we were paying for our own hotel rooms. And it was, and he didn't like that. And he got that sort of message that, no, things weren't, nothing was, you know, there was no sort of friendliness there. I even mentioned it to the Beatles. I said, I'm worried about Arthur. I said, he's good. I was worried enough. Because in those days, you didn't really want to upset anybody because he could have just said, oh, you can go home, you know. He seemed to be the one in charge who was travelling with the group. And he was being sort of a bit too friendly with me. And he just made me feel uneasy the whole time. So I just, everywhere we went, I would change the singles into doubles. And then by the time, sort of about 4 days down the line, the next hotel, no, there's no booking. I didn't actually dare to say, was there ever a booking and was it cancelled? I didn't think at the time to ask that. I just said, have you got anything? They said, no, the town is so busy. I said, can you phone around another hotel? They said, there's nothing in town because it's a big Beatles concert. Wonderful Egg Pod Express. I mean, we knew Neil and Mal Evans very well, because we used to sit in the dressing rooms a lot together. I mean, we even used to have this sort of this little factory, this line conveyor belt of doing autographs, which at the time I wondered a bit, because I actually got an original one. Luckily, I have a picture of John sort of signing my signed picture that I've got of doing people's autographs. And I felt a bit uneasy at the time, but the boys sat there. I mean, they were sitting there as well. It's just that from one place to the next, and this is right from, Bournemouth and whatever, it was everything was snowballing very steadily but quite quickly. So even things like autographs. So morally, I thought, well, it's sort of cheating. But then I thought, if I was a young girl and I'd put my book in at the stage door, would I rather get it back empty or some very, very... They could have hit lucky and got an original. But there was also myself, Neil, Mal, Tony Bramwell, whoever was around. And we'd all, you know, they had a set there and we copied them.
Oh, so you did them as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No, I sometimes wonder. And I thought, I wonder if somebody's got mine, my copy.
Well, there is a market now for Neil and Mal Beatles autographs.
There's, oh, is there?
Oh, people who collect anything.
No, I used to, it was a sort of moral dilemma. And I thought, no... What they don't know won't hurt them, and if they hit lucky, they could, or at least out of the four autographs, one of them could have been the real John, or you know what I mean? They could hit lucky. John's was different because he usually put someone's name, or he usually did a little bit more. The others usually just did their name, or he'd do a sort of a not quite best wishes, but like John Lennon, the Beatles, or his was a little more elaborate. So you'd probably guess if it was one of his. If it was just John Lennon, maybe not, but. Yeah, and I sort of thought, no, I'd rather get my book back and think and believe it's them rather than get back a book. Sorry, they didn't have time.
Yes.
So I thought, but we all sat there and they sort of passed them along. So, I mean, you never sat quietly. And again, it was all sort of, they liked to fill their time. They didn't actually sort of sit there a lot, but all they were talking. I mean, sometimes in the early days they'd talk about songs and... Because they were quite, not quite part of the furniture, because you were there and you were quite friendly and you weren't going to, I wasn't the news of the world or, do you know what I mean? And a couple of things like, you know, John being married, that was quite embarrassing because sometimes everyone would say to me, ask him if he's married. And there's all these rumours about he's married. So I very sort of gingerly would say, John, there's all these rumours that you're married. He said, oh, I'd tell you if I was. So I said, okay, but, you know, I had to ask you. And you said, yeah, fine. Anyway, at this thing, as I was telling you, the birthday party, Billy J. Kramer in Bournemouth, where they were all together for a week. I got there the day early for the birthday party, Billy J.'s birthday party, the day before Fiona arrived with her cameras, you know, which was our proper session with the Beatles. And I was in the ladies of the hotel. Cynthia, who I... came to understand with Cynthia. I'd seen her around at some recordings like Easy Beat, you know, BZBC.
Yes.
Recordings, things like that. So I knew her visually and guess she was some sort of a girlfriend at least. Not, of course, having realised that she was also a very, very new mother, which John's behaviour wasn't exactly a single man. Don't forget, the evening at the Blue Angel, he must have been a very new young father at the time, right? And he wasn't exactly acting as a... I would say flirty, but, you know, you wouldn't guess he was sort of there was a woman at home with a baby or... Well, I must also say that nobody ever, ever let on. There was never any hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, nothing like that. They were obviously very well schooled by Brian Epstein, who, and in those days, probably quite true, that if you were married, you would lose fans, or it was important to think that someone was available.
Brian.
You know, like, oh, no, or steady girlfriends, things like that. I think you were sort of allowed a girlfriend. That was all right because they still weren't sort of attached. But a wife would have been, and a baby, not sure. Although Tom Jones got a, yeah, he was always quite.
Well, yeah.
He never tried to hide a wife or a child. So he sort of out, mind you, he didn't act like a...
Well, when you're getting 200 pairs of knickers thrown at you, I suppose.
No, that's another subject, which is also very interesting in that, even as a female, I can understand. Sorry, I'll just finish that part of it. I'm in the ladies and this young lady with long blonde hair is standing next to me and smiles. She's very nice, smiles, and I smile back. She said, oh, why are you here? Are you here for the party? And I said, yes. And she said, who are you with? And I said, no, I'm not with anybody. I said, no, I'm still down for Billy J's party. I said, we were on the riverboat yesterday. And he said, as you're coming down to Bournemouth anyway, come a day early. And I think I must have said who I was, and I was, worked for boyfriend. And I sort of just sort of nodded to her, and she said, I'm Cynthia, John's wife. And I said, oh. So I sort of stood there and sort of smiled at her. Anyway, we were still making this small talk as we walked out, and then who's standing there waiting but John Lennon? So very gingerly sort of looking at me, And I said, oh, I said, hi, John. I said, oh, hello, John. I hadn't seen him that evening. You know, it was his first time I'd seen him. So he went, oh, hello, Maureen. Da, da, da. So, yeah, hello, nice to see you. Anyway, later on, he came over and he said, I'm sorry about it. He said, a bit sort of flannelish. He said, I would have told you. He said, but I knew you probably wouldn't be able to keep it a secret. So I said, oh, yeah, okay. So that's how that was sort of explained. But all very well. As I say, he gave no indication of his real true status or about a child. But I think the whole thing probably was a shock to him. And it was obviously at a time of conflict with the life.
But you did suddenly keep it secret, didn't you?
Hmm?
You did, once you knew, you did keep it secret.
Yes, I did. And it came out and someone said, oh, John Lennon is married. I said, yeah, I know. And they said, you knew? And I said, yes. I said, look, if I'd have, at that point, you could see how Epstein reacted to me in smaller ways. If I'd actually broken that sort of, it wasn't a promise, but it was an unwritten thing. No, I knew something, and I was friendly enough that I could see it was a secret for a reason. I said, they might not have spoken to me again, or said, oh, no, you know, even if they said okay to boyfriend, because they still wanted this sort of basic base camp sort of publicity, they wouldn't see me. And I was quite, I felt quite friendly with them. It had gone very well. So I said, no. And they said, oh, you wouldn't know a good story if you sat on it. And I thought, well, I'm not a trained journalist as such. I just, as a sort of rapport, and I didn't think it was worth spoiling.
That's very similar to, I interviewed Annie Nightingale a few years ago.
Oh, right.
And when she was at Apple, she knew about Yoko. You know, John was with Cynthia, but she knew about Yoko.
Yeah.
And she had a dilemma, do I report this, but I can't, and she didn't, she just kept doing, and she was worried when it did get found out that they'd think it was her, but she never did, she never told anyone.
No, sometimes, I mean, fate, it's not, first of all, it's really not your own business, it's not your life, but you are in show business, where it is like, some people think you should show and tell everything, but Cynthia came across again, another, that's, I think the Scotch club, the drinking establishment of the time, and just about to leave into Mason's Yard. I remember the cobblestone yard, Mason's Yard. And John walks in with Cynthia. So, I mean, they sort of, I mean, as before, when, you know, we like come to the party at Moody Booze, they sort of latch on to, when they walk into a place, even at the time, they were quite sort of big, even then. And also very much so amongst their own, because Scotch was very much, I mean, you get Sir Eckburn, the Animals, Mick Jagger. These are kind of other people there, even Tom Jones. People like that were, you know, other people there. So they liked, if they walked in and they caught someone's eye that they knew, they'd sort of, and John, as I say, and John said, oh, I said, no, just going. He said, oh, stand, have a drink. So the table, in fact, was quite near the door, you know, the exit. So I said, okay, you know, sat down and having a drink, which, of course, always quite lucky, whenever they walked in anywhere, you'd have to pay for your own drinks. But as soon as they walked in, bottles would go on the table. Like, right. What would you like? Bottle of Scotch, bottle of this, you know, free. And you think, isn't that great, right? They could afford it and they get it for free.
Yeah.
Anyway, so sitting there and there was a thing of flowers on the table. Since it'd be, I always remember this, pulling some petals off the flower and going, John, can we go home now? Again, thinking back, she had a young child at home, right? Probably a babysitter or someone. And he goes, he said, the driver's outside. If you want to go, like, you go. I'm not go. Just didn't want to go home. But obviously been somewhere previously. I don't know where. So we were just chatting away, sort of about nothing, you know, just, and people in the club that night. And she, you know, three or four times, she'd go, John, can we go? And he'd go, no. And that was not long before he met Yoko. And, of course, almost next door to the Scotch is the gallery where he met her. Literally, I didn't...
The Indica.
Yeah, almost next door to the Scotch in Mason's Yard. So whether he was in the Scotch and was next in, and looked in the window of the gallery, seems a coincidence. It's right next to one of his favourite places to indulge. Yeah, so I saw him one more time, again at another club, the Speakeasy, but we moved on a couple of years. We're at the Speakeasy is the place to be. And I saw him coming towards me with Yoko. And I was just about to say, oh, hello, John. And I looked and he was obviously into something or other because his eyes just went straight through me. And I thought, no, I just thought I'd be so embarrassed if I said, hello, John. And there was no reaction. Like, who, what, like, who are you? And obviously people would notice, like, oh, she's saying hello, and he doesn't know her. And I just looked at him, and he was still looking at me, but there was nothing there. It was like dead. His eyes were glazed, and so that's the last time I saw him. But Yoko was sort of trailing behind him. That's the last time I actually saw him. But no, I just could see there was nobody in. You know, there was a vacant.
Wow. Because, I mean, we all make mistakes. I've made some terrible mistakes in magazines I've worked on. Wasn't there a story where he's fumbling his glasses and you put something down?
Yes. Now, that obviously was one of my silly... I've made a few, not many, but that was one of my mistakes that I presumed at that point everybody had a mother and father, right? And it was just a throwaway line in I think it was Boyfriend. It must have been Boyfriend, yeah, because I remember walking into the dressing room. And that was the year, and I was still at Boyfriend. I moved on to Rave in 64. So it must have been 63. And it was a dressing room, and I walked in, and we always took them the latest. They were always quite interested, the latest copies of whatever, you know, with the pin-ups and what was in it and whatever. So we always took them copies of all the magazines that we had. And he just sort of called me to one side and said, Maureen. I said, yes. He said, that last thing, he must have seen the one before. It wasn't the one I just gave him. The one before, where I'd mentioned about John's mother, some passing remark about a sort of real throwaway line.
Yes, yeah.
Which I could have attributed probably to, or maybe I meant to, or misheard. And it was Paul, well, of course, Paul's mother was dead, so that would have been a mistake as well. Yes, I could have gone into, but yeah, Ringo, or George, I don't know, but I attributed, yes, I unfortunately attributed it to John's mother, who told me, no, his mother was dead. Now, I was always obviously very lucky with him because I had seen the other side of his. He could be terribly hard and I suppose the word it's not quite cruel, but very harsh. I suppose is the word with people, even with Brian. But I had seen him against people who were quite sort of innocent, like sort of doorman or whatever. You could feel the people from the side of his side, and these were elderly people as well. Some of them they weren't sort of people of his own equal or. But he never talked down to anybody that worked for him. I mean, Neil Aspinall and Mal and Tony Bramwell, they were treated everyone sort of like friends, yeah, from Liverpool.
Well, they were.
There was but there was no sort of pecking order. I mean, Neil obviously had the job of like packing. I mean, the very first time I met them, he really was the roadie. He was the physical. Obviously, they took on other people gradually. But Neil obviously was promoted up. You know, then they got Mal and then Tony Bramwell. But no, treated and took them with them up, you know, as far as Apple. So, no, they did like having people around them. And they did appreciate other people as well from Liverpool. They've been with them all the time. So for that first year, gone very well. But as I say, then they sort of ballooned, their popularity ballooned so much that getting access was very difficult.
They're working very hard, actually, at the moment. I spoke to Paul this afternoon and I was surprised, actually, because... off the new album, I thought that I know of three tracks. I've heard three tracks, and they've got nine done. He told me, but the nine have got to be completed. You know, there's various things that have got to be put onto them and so on. So nine is pretty well near the mark. I don't know whether in that nine he's including the two at the moment, probably for America, I suppose. They'll put the singles on, although I wish they wouldn't. We always have arguments with Capital as to whether they should put the singles
Penny
on
Lane
or not.
Strawberry.
But I hope they don't, because it's Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane is selling here better than our last few singles, and those are pretty big. So... it'd be very nice for America if we didn't put on the two singles.
Include
something else, something fresh. Mm-hmm. Because the album is going to be, well, I didn't like to sort of be particularly swanky about it, but it is going to be great.
But the other thing with Epstein that I blotted in my copy book was this win a prize, you know, a date.
Oh, yeah.
Which again was a Boyfriend, and Boyfriend you could win a date with literally, I mean, we had Adam Faith. I mean, these were, at the time, much bigger than the Beatles. Yeah, well-established people. Cliff Richard, who'd been big for years. Yeah, really, I think he was still the top one. So it was quite normal. And I definitely asked the boys, definitely, because I always asked them first. And they would always say, yeah, sort it out with the office. Yeah, Tony or whoever was the, I think it was Tony at the time. And they said, yeah, fine. So I phoned up with Tony and he said, yes, fine. I mean, I knew the setup well enough to know that you asked first. You didn't sort of say, oh, we'll do a date with the Beatles and then we'll tell them. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I might have been a bit, started off a bit green, but no, even I wouldn't be that stupid. And as it was a done thing it was that kind of publication, it was a normality. All right, it was the Beatles and it was big, but it wasn't like, oh, impossible, out of this world. No. So we put it in. Tony had agreed. Again, this is my one lesson in life, get things in writing. Doesn't matter how well you get on with people or chit-chat or all this, and it's all verbally okayed. Suddenly I get a call after publication of win the competition, you know, date with the Beatles. A call from Tony Barrow saying, oh, Maureen, can you call Brian up in Liverpool? So I said, yeah, what's it about? He said, it's this date thing. And I said, what about it? And he said, he wants to talk to you about it. So Tony was being very, I think Tony must have got in a lot of trouble. I mean, I went to work for Tony later on as, you know, in public relations. So, I mean, I always got on well with Tony. And again, I realised it wasn't worth falling out with anyone because I still needed Tony. Tony, to some extent, still needed me. So we stayed friends. If the falling out was going to happen, it was obviously going to be me and Brian. So I found out, I said, oh, hello, Brian. I had a little, I said, I understand you want to have a word with me. He said, what is this? He said, offering my boys as prizes. I said, yes. I said, they said it was okay, you know, fine with them. I said, and I arranged it with Tony. Tony knows nothing about it. And I thought, you sod. Yeah, that, you know, and I thought, well, I can see where I am here. I'm really up the creek. Yeah. I said, I'm sure he did. And it was like, I mean, luckily he didn't say, have you got him writing? He wasn't that mean. You know, I'd been that stupid. But obviously Tony had gone into trouble. And obviously he was told in probably in no uncertain manner, don't ever let this happen again. So in fact, accidentally, I'm the only person who's ever given away the Beatles, as Brian would put it. I'm the only person in the world that ever accidentally offered his boys as prizes. So I was sitting there with the phone. I mean, I didn't know what to do. And I said, look, but he was quite, you know, really angry. And I said, Brian, I said, look, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, if he's that upset. And I said, do you want us to, like, cancel it or whatever? I said, you know, is that what you want? And I was thinking, oh, I'm going to get in real trouble here. How can you print, yeah, date with Cliff and then pull it back and say, oh, sorry, no. He said, oh, that would look good, wouldn't it? He said, that, you know, how would it look? You know, his boys. He was calling the boys.
Yeah.
How would that look? They'd, you know, they'd get the bad image, whatever. I said, well, I suppose. Oh, yeah, I wasn't trying to be clever. I said, yeah, I suppose so. I said, but what do you want me to do? He said, and it was like, oh, I suppose we'll have to go ahead with it then. And I said, well, I said, that would be good if we could, you know, if we could. I was sitting there like, you know, please say yes. Please don't get me into trouble. And it was like, oh, well, you'll hear later on, like when we can do it, when we can, you know, fix it up. So I said, oh, thank you, Brian. And he was like, okay, all right, yeah, bang. So, and I went, oh, God. I said, I did say, I'm, as far as I'm concerned, it was agreed. It was all nicely done and whatever. But, you know, he didn't like it and it was a bad day and Tony had denied it. Anyway, it did happen. It did happen. And on the day, It was a strange thing because I was supposed to pick them up from Monmouth Street, Nems, and I had a big limousine, an Austrian Princess. I used to go around sometimes as Austrian Princess with the driver, but, you know, only for other, not for my own personal use, no. But special occasions, and this was deemed special occasion.
Cool.
They would arrive in an Austrian Princess. And also, I think probably Brian stipulated, and I thought, well, what kind of car? I can't squash them all. What can you squash them into? Right. So, and even our bosses said, oh, we'll hire a car. Okay. So At the end of the day, I get to Monmouth Street. The only one there is Paul, as I say, good old Paul. He's there. I'm told George and Ringo, who by this time I think had their own flat, they were going to make their own way there, as would John. So it's just Paul and I in this limo. And we head off from Covent Garden. I remember going down. So we're progressing down Oxford Street to turn left into Bond Street. And as we get into Bond Street, about halfway down, this is the old Vienna, one of my boss's sort of favourite watering holes, nice restaurant. There were sort of crowds on the pavement and police holding it back. And Paul sort of said, I wonder who's coming down here. Like totally not thinking it could be for them. And he said, it must be someone like the Queen Mother or someone like that. So I'm sitting there with him. I'm like, yeah, it could be. Like, no idea. So we're just chatting away. And then gradually the car pulls up at the old Vienna restaurant. And there's these police holding back crowds and whatever. So Paul, very ungentlemanly, sort of the door. I think one of the police members is the door. And Paul sort of is pushing me out first. And I'm going, no, into this sort of heaving crowd, who at the time, any time I had been with them and there were fans around, they didn't take kindly to anybody that was with them, you know, at all. So I thought, he's pushing me into the baying crowd. And they're probably going, who's she? Or what? You know, and I thought, so I went first and he was behind me, sort of propelling me. And we're going through this crowd. We arrive into the restaurant like, oh, like, we're here, we've made it. George and Ringo were there.
Hence.
Yeah, they made their own way there. So I don't know what happened when they arrived and or what car they were in or whatever. And sometime afterwards, John Lennon arrived, wet hair, obviously overslept, soaking wet hair, obviously arrived in a hurry, and it all went very well.
Oh, wow.
But again, and I had to, you know, I got a letter from Epstein saying, the boys should be picked up, you know, from NEMS in Liverpool. So he was still running things, very much hands-on guy. And I was still invited to, although obviously he took, you know, we've had a little sort of, I don't consider we fell out. It's just misunderstandings happen.
And, yeah.
And I was in no position to be, you know, I could tell that this was a sort of the bloodline.
There's an interview with Brian. Hmm. Where he's saying, you're not very keen on delegating, are you? And Brian says, no, I hate it. And he says, but now I've got all these other bands. Hmm. I have to. So I'm guessing that would have been part of his, perhaps, attitude.
Handing over, yeah.
See, I told you I shouldn't delegate.
Probably. But Tony, I mean, Tony was obviously in an awkward position there. He obviously got into trouble. I had dealt with Brian in the beginning, I had to phone Brian and say, after that first session, you know, where we had to arrange a photo session, which turned to the Euston Road one, I phoned Brian up. That's another thing, actually, the Sloane Square magazine, which is my local sort of free giveaway. They have this thing that for a certain time in 1963, they were staying up at the Sloane Square Hotel. Brian always stayed there. And then the Beatles, on the day of the recording, that last recording at Stowe, and the next day for the EMI thing, at that point, they were still up at Sloane Square. So when they came to see me at Regent Street for the session, they were coming from the Sloane Square Hotel. They were still staying there. And at the time of the first reception, they were
up there. So you were there.
Brian.
Yes.
Yeah, so I just sort of, I was going to let the Sloane, because they sort of say Brian Epstein stayed here. I was going to say, well, the Beatles actually stayed here as well. So
yeah, that's, yeah. But that was the day, so there's a day's difference between the Stowe School concert.
And the next day was the first time I met them. So Stowe was April the 4th, and it was one of their last sort of £100 odd bookings. And Stowe, I think, was also one of those. But he was thinking of the boys, like with the sort of being married, like, no, it's image, it's whatever. Even at that time, although he wasn't, Brian wasn't professional in looking after artists, he obviously was sort of learning on the job. But looking back, I mean, they were always, their clothes, they were always smartly dressed. I mean, he took care of everything because he was at that stage. I mean, when he was doing, I can't remember what year it was, the Savile Theatre, used to go every Sunday. There were incredible concerts every Sunday. Yes. That was a date in my diary. I mean, you have Jimi Hendrix, The Who. Every Sunday there was something, Clapton. Yeah, great concerts there that he was running. He'd totally come out of his shell. He was like, he used to wear long flowery scarves. And, wow. Oh, he was like a butterfly. Yeah. Before that, Brian, beautiful, immaculate, three-piece suits. Yeah, very smart, a gentleman. So quite posh, you know, Liverpool posh, very well educated. And that's the way he came over, but a gentleman. But that was just the one occasion. I say, once I caught his eye, he had to sort of admit, you know, oh, come, you better come in. He wasn't going to say, no, sorry, you know, shut the door. But I don't know why but say there were a couple of things I obviously upset him. And that was, he could have been a sort of slight revenge thing. But in the end, with the winner date, again, he was thinking of them. It would look badly on them if I had to do a retraction and say, oh, I'm sorry, it was all a mistake. There is no winner date with the Beatles. But when I went to work for Tony, I never brought up the subject. I'd sort of leave that.
And that's the end of part one. However, you can listen to the whole interview at patreon.com/eggpod. Join us next week where Maureen discusses her time at Rave magazine and, in particular, her friendship with the Rolling Stones, Graham Nash, and so many others. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod.